Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Abhijit Phanse and Andy Rappaport. Abhijit will make a short presentation, followed by informal conversation with Andy. On your left is Andy Rappaport. Andy Rappaport is a partner at August Capital since 1996. Andy brings technology and market experience into such areas as semiconductors, broadband, communications, computer systems, and software. He has more than 20 years' experience as a founder, investor, and or director of venture-backed startups, and has served on the boards of more than 40 public and private companies. Prior to joining August Capital, Andy was involved in the formation and success of more than a dozen venture capital-backed startups, including Actel, MMC Networks, Sequence Design Automation, Silicon Architects, Transmeta, and ViewLogic. In addition, Andy was president of the Technology Research Group, TRG, a Boston-based strategy consulting firm he founded in 1984. Through this firm, he provided business strategy counsel to senior executives at many of the large electronics companies around the world, including Alcatel, AT&T, EDS, IBM, and Intel. Before starting TRG, Andy was senior editor of EDN Magazine, a research physicist with Panametrics, Inc., and founder and president of his own consumer electronics company. He was also a founder of the Massachusetts Center for Technology Growth, a private economic development organization, and the director of the Massachusetts Mike Lake Electronics Center. Andy is an often-cited authority on changing technologies and markets, and has written and lectured extensively on the evolving structure of semiconductor, computer, and telecommunications industries. He wrote The Computerless Computer Company, which won the 1991 McKinsey Award for Article of the Year in the Harvard Business Review. Andy attended Princeton University. On your right is Abhijit Phanse. Abhijit Phanse is the managing partner of Axelon Capital, a private equity fund focused on investing in small to mid-market growth stage companies. He has over 15 years of experience in starting, growing, and operating businesses within a large public company and while building his own technology startup. Previously, Abhijit was the CEO of Synthera, a Silicon Valley technology startup which built high-speed signal processors for solving wireless infrastructure bottlenecks. Abhijit co-founded Synthera in his apartment in the fall of 2001. He built a top-tier investor syndicate with venture capitalists such as August Capital, Kleiner Perkins, Seven Rosen Funds, and Ridgewood Capital. He built a world-class team and helped develop a worldwide standard for Synthera's technology. In 2004, the Electronics Design News recognized Abhijit for being one of the top innovators in the networking industry. Prior to starting Synthera, Abhijit held management positions at National Semiconductor, where he led the development and commercialization of three generations of Ethernet networking products. He was also the architect of the core Ethernet technologies, which led to many successful products. Abhijit has an MS in management from Stanford Business School, an MS in electrical engineering from the University of Central Florida, where he topped the graduating class, and a BTech in electrical engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. He has authored numerous publications and has over 50 U.S. patents. Abhijit.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Thank you, Chisako, for inviting Andy and myself to talk to you today. And thank you to the Commonwealth Club for giving us this opportunity. It is a great platform here for thought-provoking discussions, so thank you for that. Now, we picked the topic for today as technology in the new economy to really understand what's changing in the macroeconomic landscape, how is that impacting technology companies, and do technology companies now need a different playbook? And I have, you know, the pleasure of Andy Rappaport, who is a great thought leader in technology investing, and you learn a lot from him today. I wanted to acknowledge Varun, Brian, and Paul for their help and research. So clearly the economy has gone through tumbles over the last year, and we all painfully see that in many ways. In fact, Q1 of this year, we had the sharpest contraction we've seen in quite a while, 6% of a $13 trillion economy, which is a lot. And it's led to a lot of pain, unemployment at 10%. Now, maybe there are some hopes on the horizon. Last quarter, our contraction was just 1%. Not too bad. However, people think that there are sometimes better metrics for how the economy is performing. Some people subscribe to the hemline theory. You know, economies have been known to soar and fall with hemlines. And in previous boom times, we've had soaring hemlines. Now, in Jan 2009, a fairly conservative dress was sold out. Now, that should tell us something. Other people believe that movie sales are a great indicator. You know, when you're hurting, you don't have money for expensive vacations, and movies are cheap entertainment. And in the last recession, movie tickets took a big jump. And we see that again in 2009, a lot of movie sales. So things are hurting, and it does impact us in different ways. I wanted to give a quick review of what I think are just three main reasons why we are in this mess, and then talk about how this is impacting the technology landscape and how this impacts technology companies. And I call them the economy busters. You know, easy monetary policy, sleazy credit, the wild, wild west Wall Street we've all, you know, come to hear so much about, and what's becoming a really, really correlated world. And it wasn't really clear to me until we started researching this topic and looking at some data how correlated we are becoming and why is that. So I call this the sleazy credit, the subprime mess. You know, people who didn't deserve a mortgage, who frankly didn't even want a mortgage, were really encouraged by bankers who didn't really care if they didn't have a job, didn't have credit, couldn't afford it, but they got a loan. They got a loan because the bankers made fees in originating that loan, and that led to the sharpest increase in subprime mortgages we've seen ever. In 2003-2004, there was almost a 5 to 10 point increase in subprime mortgages as a percentage of total mortgages written, and that led to a lot of excessive borrowing by people who didn't deserve it. Now, this didn't really stop with homeowners. Now, we've gotten into an era where risky business is highly incented. Management is incented to take risk. And anyone who invests money typically compares a risk versus a reward. You want more. You want to take more risk. You have to be compensated with more reward. Unfortunately, management in a lot of companies, particularly in financial institutions, had been incented to increase the debt-to-equity ratio, the leverage ratio, to as much as 30 times. Now, just let's understand what that means. I own a home. I put 20% down. I take a mortgage for 80%. My debt-to-equity ratio, leverage ratio, is a factor of 4. traditionally banks have run with, you know, leverage ratios in 10, maybe 15. And with a lot of regulation, that's still considered to be fairly safe. Now, as you can see, the run-up to 2007 took leverage ratios for financial institutions, and these are all the marquee investment banks, to as much as 30. That's a lot of risk-taking. Now, I think a part of this is because we have golden parachutes. Contractually, we allow people to live another life, and I think this has led us to excessive risk-taking. The other phenomena, which I call the wild, wild west, is securitization. I call it the art of obfuscation. The financial system historically has been one where you want transparency, you want to know how things perform. But in the last 5 to 10 years, a movement to actually confuse has really gotten a lot of momentum, and people have made a lot of money from it. Banks who traditionally originated a loan because they believed in the lender and they could actually see you in your face and say, you're going to give me back my money back, so you'll take $100,000 to buy a house, were not really keeping the loans, were packaging them to investment banks who made more fees by slicing and dicing them into various different categories and selling them to investors. Everybody made fees on this. Unfortunately, some investors lost money. That's because these loans went to people who didn't deserve them. There's another phenomena which I call the always insure phenomena. And I take the case study of this company we all have come to love, Always Insurance Company. It's rated AAA for always, always, always. And they always insure. Now, I happen to own my life insurance through a company very similar to this one. And when this insurance company wrote my contract, they knew that I didn't want to die. I want to live. I'm a known risk quantity. I'm, you know, 37 years old. I don't smoke, and I don't jump out of planes, although I'd like to. I'm a known risk quantity. I was a collateralized obligation, so they had to set aside money to actually write my insurance policy. And I was the only guy betting on myself. There was nobody else betting that, am I going to win? Am I going to lose? Am I going to live? Am I going to die? Now, what happened was Always Insurance Company figured out that they could make a lot more money by insuring a lot more kinds of things, corporations. Now, so you see a corporation there, and then they thought they could insure the corporation's debt. Now, interestingly, there are lots of similarities but differences between the corporation and myself, another asset. Corporations are incented to be higher risk takers. Many times, they're unknown risk. Transparency of balance sheets is the biggest issue today. How would you know where the mortgages originated and, you know, how risky is there? Are there holdings? Always Insurance Company could actually set up this contract without collateral. So they could do this as much as they wanted, make transaction fees, and had no need to collateralize the obligation. Isn't that scary? And lastly, there were multiple bets. You could bet that this company was going to go down and their debt was going to go down the hole, and therefore you could bet on that. You could short that, and you could bet, you could have 100 people betting on a single asset. And that's led to $60 trillion of contracts being written. That's five times or four times the U.S. economy. That's a staggering amount. The third phenomena I want to bring to bear is what I call the correlated world. And the world is getting exceedingly correlated. I want to talk about derivatives. The derivatives started in the late 80s, and through the 90s, they actually got a lot of, they were quite useful. Alan Greenspan would say derivatives softened the blow of the economies. They have their use. But as in 2002, the total derivatives written for the first time exceeded the world economy. So what's a derivative? Something which is derived of another financial product. And in large part, they're swaps. So someone in Japan needs, you know, U.S. dollar cash flows. Someone in America needs yen cash flows. And they decide, let's trade them. You give me your cash flows in the U.S., I'll give you my cash flows in Japan. It's a swap. It's a counterparty transaction. Interestingly now, the world economy is at $60 trillion, and derivative contracts are at $560 trillion. That's 10 times the world economy. That's a staggering amount of contracts. Obviously, everybody's interconnected through these financial contracts. It makes us that much more interdependent and correlated. Another phenomena is the packaging mortgage, you know, action. The theory was, if anyone's gone camping, you have a scout's rope. It's made up of these little twines. So you're not buying, you know, you're buying a rope which is a bundle of smaller ropes. So not all of them are going to go bad, and this rope is going to be really strong, and you can use it as when you're camping. Now, what no one thought was if one piece or one pipe or one string goes bad, it was considered to be independent of every other string in that bundle. But what if it could influence it? What if it, through viral fever, could actually affect or infect every other string, and therefore everyone would go down together? That's exactly what happened. With subprime lending, we had foreclosures. That meant drop in property prices. A lot of people had taken home equity loans based on these hypothetical prices and equity they'd built up on their homes. There was suddenly wealth destruction. They were faced with upside-down mortgages. That led to more foreclosures. All of a sudden, we realized that the mortgage performance had created a correlation. And there was a greater risk of default than one had ever fathomed in all the financial analysis that they ever modeled. It's a lot more correlated. So this is what I call the proof in the pudding. So we ran some numbers, and anyone who's done investments, again, you know, understands portfolio theory, which very simply is you have to invest in diversified assets so when something goes up, something else will go down, and your overall portfolio is pretty safe. And emerging countries has evolved over the last couple of decades as a great alternative investment, which was uncorrelated or supposedly uncorrelated because of the, you know, nascent forms of their economies to a developed economy. And we've run the correlation, which is the figure in the yellow, of, let's say, the S&P, a developed index, with the Hang Seng, which is the Hong Kong index, and with the BSE, which is a Bombay, India index. And interestingly, the correlations have always been low, and the 0.2 is, on a scale of minus 1 to plus 1, is a fairly low correlation. Interestingly, since last September, the correlations, or the polynomial fit of the correlations, are almost getting to 1, which means these markets are behaving very similarly. Has these interconnectedness, did they exist before September? Surely they did. But what happens with this financial crisis is we're all understanding how interconnected we are and how correlated the world is becoming. So this is really scary. Now, what does this mean to the U.S. economy? Of course, we are spending a lot of money, and our commander-in-chief has got a plan in place. And, you know, he wants to reduce the deficit by half. That's a noble goal. But we still have a very, very, very onerous deficit, which is leading to a huge U.S. debt. Now let's put in perspective what this means. As a percentage of GDP, 20% of the GDP is typically the tax revenue of the U.S. Treasury. Roughly 5% is your entitlements to Social Security. Medicare and Medicaid, which is the fastest growing obligation, along with Social Security, is set to bankrupt the government or the Treasury in the next 30 years. This doesn't even include the interest which the U.S. owes on its treasuries, on its massive debt. So clearly this has lasting implications as how there's going to be political reform, how businesses will get impacted. And we'll look at a little more in the following section. The bottom line, really, this has become a crisis of transparency. And the LIBOR-OIS spread, and what that simply means is LIBOR is the London interbanking rate. It's the rate at which banks will lend to each other. The OIS is an average, 30-day average of the Fed rate. These rates should be pretty close because, hey, you can borrow from the Fed and you can then lend it to someone else. And historically, it's been at 10 basis points or 0.1%. This shot up to over 350 basis points in the fall of last year. Why did that happen? That premium was because people didn't want to lend to each other. They didn't trust other people because what was on their balance sheets, no one really knew it. It was good or was bad. It was a transparency issue, and that is really the bottom line. And the lack of credit is choking the U.S. economy in many ways and choking businesses. So let's understand how this macro context might impact technology businesses. Now, if I look at technology businesses traditionally, it's been an innovation engine. You want something faster, you want something better, you want something cheaper, and it's built on high R&D spending. Now, in large part, that's been funneled, the innovation, especially the early innovation, by venture capital Andy's a great venture capitalist, a very successful one. And he's invested in some great companies, including mine. Now, venture capitalists have gotten their money from financial institutions, endowment funds, from universities. And a guy called Dave Swenson from Yale started this alternative investment theory quite some time ago, which has really led to a large allocation of limited partner or endowment fund monies to venture capital, which has really been the source. Now, what's happened with stock markets falling is that all of a sudden, the equity part of Dave Swenson's portfolio at Yale University is significantly smaller than what it was before. And therefore, they've gotten over-allocated on the equities part. And part of that is causing some restrictions in their ability to continue upping their investment into venture capital. Now, I know Andy's firm had a very successful raise earlier this year, but a lot of venture capitalists are not being able to tap into the same resources they were able to tap a few years ago. Will that change? Have technology businesses get impacted? Well, we'll find out. Now, the other issue which I see is innovation, or the premium for innovation, has always been funneling the monies required to go invest in R&D. A simple example is the iPhone, started at $600, and today is south of $200. And in the early years, Apple could skim the market, make a lot of money, and funnel that money back into its innovation engine. What happens if adoption is delayed? Because consumer spending, which is 70% of our GDP, which we know is contracting, is on the down. And adoption of innovative products is delayed. Does this mean there's less money under that curve and less money which can fuel innovation? So a big question in my mind is, can the innovation premium be sustained? We took a look at R&D spending, and this is what funnels innovation. And it's been fundamentally in the 10 to 15% for large companies like Microsoft and Exxon and IBM. And it's been in the 20 to 30% for smaller companies. Now, on the whole, the R&D spending has declined slightly. And a few cases where it's larger as a percentage of revenue is because the top line has gotten down and they've not been able to shrink their R&D fast enough. Like Palm, and Microsoft in this case continues to spend as much as it wants to because of its cash balance sheet, and therefore those numbers are slightly high. What we found was R&D spending is more or less steady. However, there are concerns that if the recovery is slower than what we all want it to be, it will slow down. Many companies are focusing on near-term projects and potentially going after less risky projects. My question is corporate America becoming more risk averse? The other question to ask is the make versus buy decision. When corporate valuations are cheaper and there are more distressed situations available, would you use your money on R&D? Or would you use it to grab market share by spending more in sales and marketing, or buying mature technology, or potentially buying revenue? So these are questions which will impact how technology businesses grow over the next 5 years. So this is the stage I wanted to set for introducing Andy Rappaport. And this is a picture of Andy when he was, Andy, were you 18 years old?
21.
When Andy founded an audio and high definition, high end audio company when he was 18 probably, and had over $1 million in sales before he was 20 years old. And this is a picture from the Rolling Stones magazine. Andy is a tremendous entrepreneur and an investor, as Chisako mentioned. And I want to quote something he said from an article which he wrote in 1991. It's called The Computerless Computer Company. Andy had the vision in 1991 to predict that by 2000, the most successful computer companies will be ones without a computer, will be ones which are not making computers because that's going to get commoditized, but ones which figure out how to use them, write applications on them. And his vision has definitely come true in this case, as it has in many other spaces where Andy has made great bets. So with this, Andy, I'd like to ask you a few questions. So my first question to you, Andy, is you've invested in some pretty successful technology companies, and you've been good at assessing trends. Will the fundamental returns on innovation be any different in this next era?
That's a good question. And before I answer it, thank you very much, Abhijit, for inviting me here. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting both of us, and especially thanks, Abhijit, for using that picture. So will we continue to see a return on innovation? I'm going to answer the question yes, but I'm going to cheat. And the way I'm going to cheat is I'm going to ask the question, how do we know something is innovative if it doesn't generate some type of interesting return? And I would argue, and I've argued in the past, that the only real measure, certainly the only valuable measure of innovation, is that it creates some kind of outsized return or there is some premium that's attached to it. And so by that definition then, yes, innovation will continue to realize some type of significant premium, but that then leads to the question, what represents innovation? And herein lies the real question. I made a terrific living for many years as a consultant, and my primary franchise was companies that were once great but had lost their way. And in the late 80s and early 90s, there was an infinite community of those companies for me to mine as clients. And the common thread for all of those companies, and this actually led to a lot of the thinking that was incorporated in the Computerless Computer Company in 91, the common thread was that these are all companies that had been innovative at one point in time, but the nature of their innovation had lost its value in the marketplace. And the natural tendency that every one of these companies has, I think this is a natural organizational tendency, it's a natural human tendency, is to repeat one's past successes. And so innovation in that context got defined as what got us here, as opposed to being defined as what is valuable in the market at this particular point in time and or what is likely to get us out of here. So our, you know, core advice to any client that took us on at that time was we said, just stop everything you're doing. Because chances are that's not very valuable. And now let's think about what innovation really is. So the question I think we have to ask ourselves is where are we going to find this innovation? It is certainly not going to be a continuous evolution of those things we've done before. We've come through a fantastic era, especially here, you know, in or near Silicon Valley, where, you know, semiconductor technology, computer technology has led to vast improvements in standard of living and health and all kinds of other things. But the question we have to ask is that where innovation is naturally going to lie? Is it going to lie naturally in getting to the next semiconductor technology node? Or is the most fruitful area for innovation healthcare technology? There's a lot of argument that for the next 50 years, that will be the most fruitful area for technology, for innovation, or energy, in energy technology. So, you know, it's a long answer to a short question, Abhijit. The answer to the question is absolutely yes if we look for innovation in the right places.
That's true, Andy. But, you know, our era right now is fundamentally different from anything we've had before. These issues are very systemic. They're not going to, you know, we're not going to come out of this soon. At least I don't think we're going to come out very soon. What do you think innovation, what role do you think innovation can actually play in helping us get out of this mess?
So that's a complicated question. It's very hard to see how we're going to get out of this mess without innovation, because at the very least, you know, if we, and if by we mean those of us who are participating in the U.S. economy, if we aren't innovative, then we're going to get out-innovated by somebody else. I mean, that's just the nature of human history. So we're not going to get out of this mess without innovation. The question that I ask, though, is innovation enough? Or, again, where do we find innovation that's actually going to do the trick? Mm-hmm. If we think about the connection between innovation and the state of the economy, mm-hmm. you know, I don't worry too much about R&D budgets because the absolute magnitude of R&D budgets is quite large in the U.S. And innovation, actual real innovation is not actually that expensive. The expensive thing is all the stuff you have to do around it that isn't innovative mm-hmm. in order to create a culture where every once in a while somebody can be actually innovative. I mean, the great example of this is like the Post-it note, which was an accidental discovery. So that didn't cost very much. It's just that 3M had to be spending a lot to create an environment where creative people could once in a while come up with a good idea. Google didn't cost that much. So I don't worry about the magnitude of R&D budgets. I think we're spending enough money, and we will continue to have enough money to spend. The economy is down, but it's not gone, right? The bigger problem that I worry about is attached to a statistic that you didn't show, which I just actually got published last week. So the data that got published last week on income disparities in the United States between the top 1% of earners and everybody else. And so the data from 2007 mm-hmm. got published, and the data from 2007 set a record. And the record was that the top 1% of earners made 25% of all income in the United States. And the previous record was set, this is far from a monotonic curve, but the previous record was set in 1928.
Wow.
And there's an interesting question if you think about, well, what happened in 1929? What happened in 2008? And I actually do not believe that this is an accident. And what this represents is, I think, a challenge to technology, technology businesses, and it represents a result of terrific innovation in technology, which is what I think of as the decorrelation between wealth and work. Right? So it used to be, if you go back certainly 100 years, if you or I or anyone in this room innovated something, mm-hmm. to realize the value of that innovation, we'd have to make something.
Right.
And to make it, we'd have to go figure out what it would take. We'd have to hire people to make it. It probably wouldn't be obvious how we would make it. We would probably make it by hand, right? And so we'd set up a factory somewhere, and we'd get some raw material, and we'd hire a bunch of people. And chances are, either those people would, you know, we'd do it right where we live, or we'd go someplace, probably in the United States, and we'd go hire a bunch of people. And that's how we ended up with Detroit.
Right.
For example, and to a large extent, that's how we ended up with Silicon Valley.
Right.
So the wealth created by innovation directly created work right nearby.
Right.
And in those circumstances, we find, and if you go back and you look through the data, you find that there's actually relative compression in wages between the top 1% and everybody else, because there's prosperity that is a natural mechanism to be spread around. Mm-hmm. As a result of technology, partly as a result of technology, but I would argue very largely as a result of technology, locality of work is no longer particularly important. In fact, one could argue it's becoming unimportant and undesirable. One of the aspects of technology is we've inverted the relationship between handcrafted and mass-produced. I'm reading a very interesting book now called Cheap by Ellen Ruppel Schell, the high cost of discount culture. And in that book, one thing that's pointed out that you don't think about very much is we take for granted now that cheap stuff, that could be pretty good, right? That when, in the early 20th century, when discounters like Woolworth started out, inexpensive discount goods were considered suspect because they were mass-produced goods. They were of inferior quality. There are a lot of reasons why that used to be true and why handmade goods used to be superior. But partly, and I would argue largely, as a result of technology, automation technology, information technology, we've created an era, and I think this is permanent, where mass-produced goods are superior. They're superior because we have higher process controls, because mm-hmm. we get economies of scale, all of these things, mm-hmm. Which means that we then naturally want to consolidate the production of these goods. As a result of technology, we can compress the difference between skilled and unskilled labor, right? A very good example of that is call center technology, where one doesn't have to be an expert because one can be prompted by an expert system. So as a result of that, we don't have to put many functions near the innovator, right? We can package up what it takes to make stuff, and we can send it to a place where it's cheaper to do, or we can aggregate things that are going to be made worldwide. So as a result of this, we have this now decorrelation between the wealth created by innovation. The owners of the invention can do extremely well, right? But the widespread, but that's disconnected from the widespread benefit of that innovation, and it's certainly become delocalized. So I think the challenge that we face is it's unclear how we can climb back out of our local economic slump in the context of a global economic slump without being at the lead in innovation. But even just being ahead in innovation. That might do very well for the innovators. That might cause the stock market to rise. But that's not going to change necessarily the relationship between the innovator and the widespread prosperity attached to that innovation. And I think unless we address that problem, which is a very tough problem, it's not obvious that that innovation is going to help us enough.
Interesting, Andy. So you've frankly expanded the scope of the problem to wealth for the common man in the United States. And that is a significant issue. Now, with China coming online and India coming online and China becoming potentially the nation which makes cars, which was, you know, a significant force in the U.S. for the last three decades, the landscape is changing in a big way. Mm-hmm. And just extending what you said, does this mean that there are going to be a lot of wealthy people in the U.S. and there are going to be people in China and India making mass-produced goods, and it's going to be tough times for the common man in the U.S.?
Well, I would argue that that's exactly where we are now. You know, when Shmuel Halevi, my co-author, and I wrote the Computerless Computer Company, I guess this was before it was published in 91, so we're coming up almost on 20 years. I remember our first meeting with our editor, who was assigned to us by the Harvard Business Review. And we sat around the table, and he said, okay, I'm supposed to edit your article. What's the thesis? And we told him the thesis, and we said, you know, that increasingly the inspiration about how to use technology is going to eclipse in value the construction of the technology itself, as you quickly summarized. And we went through the thesis, and he said, and remember, this was 20 years ago, and he said, oh, I get it. So what you're saying is that in the future, the world is going to have a few Robert Redfords who do extremely well because of their innovation and their star power, and they're going to get all the spoils, and everybody else is going to be left to pick up after them. And that's haunted me for 20 years. And if you think about what's happened, a lot of that has, in fact, happened. So I think we have a couple of challenges that we face. So as you point out, you know, other economies, among them China and India, are on the ascent and will remain on the ascent. So we can't think about what we do here in technology businesses independent of what's happening in many other places. I mean, a newly consolidated Europe is strengthening its position with respect to innovation in particular in technology. So we can't believe that we're living in a protected environment and we can't escape the effects of globalization of our markets. At the same time, though, we have to think not only about how do we compete in those global markets, but we have to think about what the nature of that competition means to our well-being here. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to, this isn't a political panel, and I don't really want to, you know, mm-hmm. sound political notes, but it really is a question of wealth redistribution. I don't think there's ever been a point in history where an economy or country has been globally competitive without having widespread well-being. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have to figure out here are where can we make investments so that we're not only likely to be as competitive worldwide as we need to be, but where the fruits of that competition can be shared sufficiently broadly, at least mm-hmm. so that we can continue to have a healthy infrastructure, a relatively healthy society.
Interesting, Andy. So now the question which pops up at me is, how should I invest money? Where do we make our place? So the first question, it's a two-part question. The first question was, are fundamentally we getting a little more risk-averse with all that's happening around us and there being, you know, better opportunities which may be lower risk and equally good return? And are those is that the fundamental nature of technology businesses or technology investing over the next decade or so? And the second part question is, if that were true, how could we then make our place such that more wealth remains within the United States?
So let's tackle that in pieces.
Okay.
So first of all, let's think about risk. So I'm supposed to be in the business of risk-taking. Mm-hmm. And in my business, I think one can do extraordinarily well if 1 out of 10 of the bets we make turns out to be a really good bet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, 9 out of 10 bets can turn out to be complete losers.
Yes.
If 1 out of 10 earns us 100-1, we've made 10-1. Right, that's not bad, or 9-1. So I'm supposed to be in the business of risk taking. I thought I was a risk taker until in 2008 I heard that Goldman Sachs' balance sheet was leveraged 40 to 1, right? So in that context, I'm a complete piker, right? Now, why is that important, right? The reason that's important is that I think as an economy, we have some finite tolerance for risk. I don't think risk is necessarily zero sum, but I think it's a limited commodity, right? And so one of the questions we have to ask ourselves as an economy is where do we want to take those risks? I think we're in a situation now, if you look at the data that you provided or you showed, I think we're in a situation now where the consequences of undue financial risk-taking, the consequence of that is that we've crowded out industrial risk-taking. Right? Because nobody can get credit in business. Right. Nobody's taking any risk because everybody's stock has been battered. Right. Nobody can afford to take any risk. Now, that's a little bit of an overstatement. Companies are still taking some risk, and we as investors are still taking some risk. But our ability to take that risk, put aside our tolerance for that risk, has been diminished as a consequence of what I consider to be undue financial risk taking. So I think one of the things we have to think about is, where do we want to take risk, right? I have no problem with financial investors taking large risks on derivative instruments as long as the success or failure that is achieved via that kind of risk-taking doesn't have a first-order effect or a limiting effect mm-hmm. on the risks that my companies can take or, you know, the companies of the people in this room or you know, the industries at large can take on developing new technologies, new products, mining new markets, and that kind of thing. So I think what we have to figure out is, you know, how do we manage the overall profile of risk so that we're not disincentivizing or restricting the ability to take industrial risk. And I think that if we do that in a reasonable way, I think companies themselves will do a good job of allocating dollars that are then mm-hmm. tolerant of risk to areas where we should be taking those risks.
That was the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, what kind of innovation can we spur to keep more of the wealth in the United States? So is that even possible?
So let's talk differently about keeping the wealth in the United States versus distributing the wealth, because those are two very different
yes.
questions. So to the question of where can we invest to keep the wealth here, I think it gets back to my answer to the first question, which is what's really innovative? Where does innovation really matter? And you know, one way to look at that are what are the problems to which enough value is likely to accrue over a long enough period of time that if you solve those problems or change the way those problems are solved, you're moving a significant amount of wealth. Mm-hmm. You know, we, and again, you know, here in Silicon Valley or near Silicon Valley, have a tendency to think about innovation and technology in relatively narrow terms. Right, we think about it as those things that have to do with information technology, and you know that have to do with you know certain forms of hardware technology, semiconductor technology, things like that. And you know we're very good at applying those kinds of technology to interesting problems. And I think there will continue to be many areas that are open to innovation in the semiconductor business, which is now a very large, very mature, relatively slow-moving business. I was joking with an old friend of mine who's a retired Intel exec over lunch today. He said, "How are you spending your time?" And I said, "I'm spending my time learning parts of the periodic table I never thought I would ever visit." Because now one really needs materials innovation in the semiconductor business. So there are opportunities for things, you know, we can look at any market, we can look at any type of product, we say, okay, we can innovate those things. And there will continue to be, at some scale and at some level, terrific opportunities there. However, let's think about where that lives in the broader context of innovation. I heard a talk a couple of months ago by a guy who has actually a joint appointment at MIT and Harvard and is now, I think, the chairman of the President's Technology Advisory Council. He's one of the individuals who first sequenced the human genome. Mm-hmm. And the talk that I was very privileged to hear was about the future of medicine and the effect of genomics on the future of medicine. And he looked at a room, and it was, you know, people the age of those of us in this room, and he said, well, this is the bad news is it's too late for all of you, and it's probably too late for your children. But before the end of their children's lives, the practice of medicine will be completely revised as a result of our ability to predict, based on genetic codes, the particular actions and interactions of individual drugs in the body, which we've never been able to do. Medicine is still black art. No one, to this day, nobody knows how aspirin works, apparently. but in 50 years, we'll be able to be very deterministic with respect to the construction of therapies based on clues and derived from genetic analysis. Genetic analysis, which no one could have dreamed of doing 20 years ago and is now becoming very routine and within 20 years will be extremely cheap. How much is that innovation worth? Right, and how much is that innovation worth relative to semiconductor innovation? I would argue it's worth a lot more. Mm-hmm. Energy, yeah. Right? I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? We face some interesting challenges. How much is that innovation worth? I'm probably not smart enough to think about other areas where we will find hugely valuable innovation. So, in terms of opportunities to create enormous wealth. Right, mm-hmm. They're absolutely there, and I believe, and I think this is true, again through all of human history, that the potential reward for innovation pretty much tracks GDP. The bigger the economy, the bigger the reward for upsetting it in some interesting way, right? I think that will always be true. But then you have to think about, okay, is it where we used to be innovative that's going to move the needle to the greatest extent, or is it someplace new? So that's the first part of the second part of your question, which okay. is. All right, so how do we create wealth here? The second part is, can we do that in a way that's more egalitarian and that has more widespread effects than the way we've done it over the last 20 years, right? And the only answer I can give to that question is, I honestly don't know, right? I really don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. We talk about creating jobs here around innovation that we're going to make solar panels here. Okay, this is a great example. We're going to make solar panels here, right? That's a new tech. Or we're going to make batteries here. Same basic math applies, right? Because, we're going to invent them here, and we have a lot of consumption here, so we're going to make them here. Well, why does it make more sense to make solar panels here than in a kind of innate way than it has made to make semiconductors here? What would possibly influence it? Well, that you have to make them close to where they're invented because the manufacturing processes are not going to be possible to package up and mass produce in ways that we've learned how to do. I don't understand what that could be, and there's already counter evidence to that, fairly strong counter evidence. Well, it's going to be too expensive to get them here. Well, that's an interesting thing. So I did the research on that, and I realized that the value per pound of a solar panel today is about the same as the value per pound of a car. Right? Well, that doesn't stop us from importing automobiles. In fact, it turns out that the cost to import a solar panel right now is something on the order of a half a cent a watt. The solar panel's worth today about $2 a watt. Solar panels are going to get more efficient. They're going to get cheaper, but they're also going to get lighter. Mm-hmm. There's no inherent reason why we mm-hmm. can't ship them as cheaply as we ship cars today. Mm-hmm. Batteries, go do the math. Same thing is going to apply, mm-hmm. right? So there's nothing inherent. Do we have a better workforce? All of these things you kind of chunk down and you say it's not obvious what it's going to be. So I think the long-term question mm-hmm. is, first, let's do the innovation, mm-hmm. right? First, let's make sure that we're investing in those areas that are likely to bring wealth here one way or another to somebody or to somebody else. And then let's deal head-on with the question of, if that isn't directly bringing with it the kind of widespread well-being that history would say is required to have a stable economy, then we need to think about how we synthesize those effects, right? And I'm not an economist. I'm not a sociologist. I don't know how to do it. But I do know that we have to be thinking about that question head on because the natural forces may not solve the problem for us.
Interesting. So, Andy, you clearly demonstrated that innovation has saved us before and it's going to save us again. Does the operating model, does the playbook change? How you get funded, how you run your business, how you potentially make money when you exit for your investors, for yourself?
So let's think about what that playbook is. I think to the first order, it probably doesn't change. So to the first order, how do you profit from innovation? You come up with an idea that is relatively inexpensive to bring to the point where it's been de-risked, protected, and can draw on large amounts of capital to be deployed widely, right? That's what venture capital is for, right? What I'm supposed to do is find things that are a little bit too risky, a little bit too early, more conventional sources of capital to fund, but where a relatively small application of capital can mature those ideas to the point where you're ready to build a factory. It's obviously why you would build a factory, and the money is available to scale up somewhere. So the idea is a relatively small amount of money nurtures an innovative idea to the point where it has more widespread capital availability, to the mm-hmm. point where it's natural to scale up. And at that time, the early investors are able to monetize their investors by basically selling stock to a different a community mm-hmm. of investors. Typically, that's done through a public offering. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of that's going to change, right? You know, we're in an IPO drought. I've seen IPO droughts before. We had IPO droughts in the 80s. We had IPO droughts in the 90s. I've also seen IPO gluts. The gluts seem to be getting bigger, right? But that's okay, right? I've never in 25 years ever been associated. I've been involved with a lot of companies. A lot of them have gone public. I've never been associated with one that should have gone public and didn't, right? I've never been associated with one that succeeded and didn't make its investors money, right? So I don't think that model's going to change, right? I think what is changing is what lives underneath the model. I think, first of all, that whereas when I started my career, the world was not correlated, in your terminology, and most markets were not global to the extent that they are now. I don't think any company can start up anywhere in the world and do something truly innovative without thinking ahead about how it interconnects with what's going on elsewhere in the world, either because the markets are global or because production needs to be global or capital is global. So I think that's something which is going to, it's something that we've been living through for the last 20 years. I think it's something which is going to become even more significant. For example, my companies typically consolidate their initial research and development in the United States and then branch out a little bit from there. And we'll go and we'll find low-cost development sites somewhere, and then we'll go find low-cost production somewhere, and then we'll start distributing around the world. I think it's going to become increasingly common that the R&D will be distributed. I think there are a lot of reasons why the R&D will be distributed. So I think there'll be things like that. I think what's going to modulate through this period, I think it'll change around, and I think any company just has to realize the environment in which it's operating, is what subsequent financing environments look like. So the IPO window opens and shuts. The criteria the companies can use to go public will change. Mm-hmm. Right now we're in a period which I think is healthy, where companies have to be relatively larger, relatively more stable, relatively mm-hmm. more profitable, but that's going to change. So there'll be a temporal component when we think about, how do you realize the spoils of success. But I think the fundamental model will remain viable. Now, with that's with one caveat. So I think that absolutely will be true with respect to the businesses that I know something about and have mm-hmm. been involved in for the last 25 years. There are areas of innovation that I know very little about, like biotech, right, where the models may evolve. And I think, the biotech models are already different because of the timescales attached to FDA trials and things like that. So biotech has its own models. I know that those models are evolving. I know that the exit environment in biotech is changing also, and so there will be different models there. So to the extent that the locus of investment moves from an area that's been hugely productive for the last 25 years to a different area that may turn out energy, healthcare, biotech, whatever it is, that may be hugely productive for the next 25 years, it may be that what we think of as the normal model is different, not because the models in areas where you've been practicing them have to change to the first order, but because what's called for in those areas may be a little bit different. So we have to be flexible in our thinking and make sure that we're kind of listening to the markets and understanding what the appropriate models are to the new areas of innovation that we'll want to mine over the next 25 years.
Very nice, Andy. So clearly the world's interconnected. Your companies have operations all over the world. The next question is, does the role of the U.S., vis-a-vis China, India, change? And let me explain that. I mean, IBM was a company which made computers. Manufacturing went away from the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's a services company. Sun Microsystems was a hardware company. It's largely a services company. Now it's, part of a software company. What's the next 10 years look like for U.S. companies? And is the role of China, India any different?
Yes, it will be absolutely different. There is absolutely no way that the relationships among countries and what's going on in those countries can remain static when those countries themselves are changing in mm-hmm. such a dramatic way, and in the case of China and India, growing, mm-hmm. at least in terms of their economies, in such a dramatic way. Let me give you an anecdote. It's kind of amusing, but it illustrates the way these things happen. So you started me thinking when you asked me for something about my past that you could use, and I sent you that article from when I was in the audio business. It got me thinking. That was a long time ago. That was 35 years ago. I started a company in 1975. In 1976, I started a company in New York State. In 1976, I started shipping product around the world, and I had a distributor in Japan. So my distributor in Japan, when he signed the distribution agreement, said, I have only one request of you, Mr. Rappaport, and that is that you use in your audio components, use capacitors that are made in the United States, and everybody knows that U.S. capacitors are the best capacitors in the world, and they were. They absolutely were. And what we need you to do when you ship these products to Japan is we need, when you assemble them, you need to assemble them so that the made in USA on the Sprague capacitors is facing up, so that when our customers in Japan take these covers off these products, they see that these components are made in the USA, because that's really respected. These are the best components. And those components, those capacitors, were handmade in North Adams, Massachusetts, in a Sprague plant. So, of course, I did that. My product sold very well. It was less than 10 years later that Intel exited the DRAM business. And Intel exited the DRAM business when Hitachi got a 64K DRAM qualified at Hewlett-Packard. Because nobody ever believed that a Japanese manufacturer, this is less than 10 years after I was told, have the made in USA face up. Less than 10 years later, Hitachi had a 64K DRAM qualified by Hewlett-Packard. And shortly after that, Intel exited the DRAM business. So actually yesterday I happened to see a different retired Intel executive who is now in the solar business, and we were talking about cost of capital. And I said, well, you remember, he was at Intel when Intel got out of the DRAM business, and I said, you remember when you guys got out of the DRAM business because the Japanese cost of capital was so much lower. And he said, and you guys couldn't compete. He said, well, that was only part of it. He didn't talk about the other part. The other part was that their yields were higher and their equipment utilization was a lot better, so even if they had the same cost of capital, they'd be cheaper. Okay, so that was a pretty quick change. 10 years after that, what happened to Japanese DRAM manufacturers? They were challenged by Korean DRAM manufacturers. Why? Because Korea decided that DRAM was a good place to, that Japan had done it, to gain technical credibility, to build scale, to do all of these things. So there is this inevitable march. By the way, the Sprague plant, where those capacitors that I used in North Adams was made, that plant is now a beautiful contemporary art museum. Right? So we don't have DRAM fabs. We don't have capacitor factories. We have a beautiful, it's a beautiful place, contemporary art museum, the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. So what does all this mean? What all this means is that what any emerging economy is going to do is they're going to figure out what does an emerged economy have. Mm-hmm. And how can we pick some of that stuff off on our way up, right? And it's happening in China. It's happening in India. It's going to be happening in Brazil. It's mm-hmm. going to be happening in other places because it's the natural course of things. Mm-hmm. So I think what we have to do, right, is we have to embrace it. And we have to say, you know what, we're not going to be able to stop it, right? These economies are too large. People are too determined. They have different factors affecting their cost of capital. Right, I have huge regard for economic planning in China because they're willing to operate on 50-year time horizons. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to discount back from capital returns 50 years hence, your capital can be pretty cheap, right? Mm-hmm. We can't compete with that. We're not going to do that here. It would be countercultural for us to do that here. So I think we just have to embrace it. I think we have to say, okay, as things mature, there will be less value attached to them. They're going to go other places. As other economies are growing, they're going to decide to pick off some things that we used to be good at and to identify some things that it'll pay to be good at in the future, and we're not going to be able to stop all of it. So I think we just have to build it into our planning, right? And we have to assume that right now it's China. Right now it's very easy to see how the impact of China increases very dramatically. Right now it's very clear that it's India. It's not obvious who else it's going to be. next, but it will be someone. And I think that we can't predict exactly what it's going to be. We can't predict exactly where those other economies are going to be strong relative to us and that kind of thing. But I think what we can do is, if we have as a mindset, all right, nothing we can do but embrace it and figure out how to be competitive even in the face of it, which we have consistently done, then I think we can prosper.
And who, with respect to planning for innovation, would you leave that to the private sector and the free market, which the U.S. has embraced over the last 100 years, or would you want a more government role in planning for innovation?
So I think that the short answer is it's going to be done in the private sector. However, it's not clear what the internet would look like if it wasn't for the ARPANET, and it's not clear that there ever would have been an ARPANET if it weren't for
Al Gore.
The government. Well, even before Al Gore, right? So I think we got to do two things. I think number one, the role of the government is to create an environment that is supportive of innovation and is most likely to foster innovation. Mm-hmm. And to do those things in those areas where innovation is most likely to be valuable, not to micromanage, but to say, okay, it's obvious that innovation is going to be hugely valuable in healthcare. It's obvious it's going to be hugely valuable in energy. Mm-hmm. Maybe some other places. So what we want to do is create an environment where it's most likely that we can be successful in those. We can innovate successfully in those areas. What is that going to take? Well, I think there is a role for government R&D spending, right? Because the government will take risks that even I won't take. Mm-hmm. They'll take risks that even universities won't take. And I think it's important to continue to take those risks. It turns out those risks are cheap, right? You don't have to spend a huge amount of money at the level at which those risks are taken. I mean, you know, to some of my companies, getting a $15 million DARPA grant looks like a huge amount of money.
Right.
But in the context of the federal budget, the sum of all of those grants is actually peanuts, right? So there is a role for doing some initial fertilization and that kind of thing. Education, right? We need to say, okay, if innovation is going to come out of certain places and we want that, you know, innovation to occur in the United States, we ought to think about how we're educating people to do it. Immigration policy, right? The thing that scares me the most right now is the fact that my companies can't hire the engineers they need and universities can't bring on board the graduate students they need from outside the United States. And so research dollars are being spent outside the United States because that's where you can get people and you can get the people you want, right? It has nothing to do with cost even. It's just you can get the visas. So that's a big place where government has a role to play. And I think, you know, if we had 3 hours, I could tick down a very long list of those things. But I think that's the place where government, and we need to be thinking about how government supports innovations. Let's create a context. Let's create an environment. Let's create a fertile a groundwork. But with respect to the specific things that are going to turn out to be valuable, that's what a marketplace does. And that's what a relatively free, unfettered market mm-hmm. does. And you know, it's interesting right now that in Japan, which became a powerhouse in semiconductors because of the central planning, because of MIDI, and having decided we're going to do this, we're going to spend the money and apportioning the money and giving different companies different projects, things that we would never do here. That in Japan worked extremely well for a while. It turns out it's now holding them back, right? Because a lot of the natural things that have occurred elsewhere have not occurred in Japan because of that kind of industrial planning. So I think we need to have this kind of separation between how do we create the context, and then how do we operate in the, you know, how do businesses operate in a relatively free and unfettered way within that context?
Thank you, Andy. I want to throw it open to, you know, better questions which can come from the audience.
Okay, great. Thank you, Andy, and thank you, Abhijit. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Technology in the New Economy with Abhijit Phanse and Andy Rappaport. Our thanks to Abhijit Phanse and Andy Rappaport for their comments here today. I am Chisako Res, chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. We have a standing microphone here, so if you have any questions, please come up and line up behind the microphone.
Hi, Andy. I'd like to follow up a little bit on your discussion of delocalization and income distribution. Now, the first place that we've really seen that delocalization was, of course, in manufacturing. So many jobs want to elect the U.S. Rapidly, though, it's been followed by services, and the services are moving rapidly up the value chain, from process-based services to conceptual and increasingly to innovative services. It appears that that shift is inevitable. Where, if that delocalization is going to continue to occur, where does the income distribution come from in the U.S. in the future? If many of the high-level jobs or mid-level jobs and services go back, is it going to come back from manufacturing with some talk about relocalizing the supply chain due to volatility, due to price increases of energy, due to political disruptions?
So that's a great question, and there are two answers to the question, one of which everybody likes and one of which nobody likes. So the question that everybody likes is that we can identify changes in the nature of the value chain such that we can recapture value even when certain parts of it have moved elsewhere. So let's take call center services, right? It's a good example, right? Moved very quickly, you know, as a services component outside of the United States. Largely as a result of our ability to automate the expertise required to provide appropriate service. Why did it move outside of the United States? Because it involves people, and people are cheaper in places like India. Is that a trend which will continue forever? Well, I would argue that unless the United States has the lowest rates for semi-skilled labor in the world, and as long as only semi-skilled labor is all that's required to do that, then we're probably not going to get those jobs back. There isn't a natural economic rationale for getting those jobs back. So I hope that I don't live in an era, and my children and grandchildren and their children and grandchildren don't live in the United States, which has the lowest wage rates for semi-skilled labor, although I fear that we're headed there. On the other hand, one can identify different aspects of value. So, for example, we have an investment in a company called LiveOps, which does distributed call centers using technology in a very interesting way. And they've been able to construct very effective call centers using, among other people, stay-at-home moms who are able to work part-time out of their homes using, you know, VoIP technology and other kinds of technology. It's not that the hourly rate for these individuals is lower than the hourly rate for individuals in India or in China or elsewhere in the world, but their productivity can be much higher in certain cases, right? So in cases of direct response to a home shopping network where one, you know, where the real value is how many people can you actually get to buy something? Well, if you can use technology to figure out how to make people really good at getting people to buy certain things, and you can steer the calls to the people who have proven themselves to be really good, then you don't have to pay a low hourly rate to create a huge amount of value. So that's an opportunity, an example of a case where in a services realm where we might say, uh-oh, it's never coming back because our wage rates are too expensive, we can redefine the nature of value such that we can make a disproportionately large contribution and cover the fact or enable us to pay higher wage rates. So those kinds of things will happen occasionally, right? We can identify cases where there is enough value that we can mine that with somewhat more skilled workers whom we pay a higher wage. That's the answer everybody likes. And what it takes to get there is thinking creatively about the nature of value and saying, okay, if it's possible that we're now able to do something with semi-skilled labor, that may not be the most valuable part of the equation. Let's redefine the most valuable part of the equation, and let's re-import it, right? The answer that nobody likes is that we may have to synthetically redistribute, right? There are two ways to do that, right? One way to do that is we might have to decide that we are willing to pay more for certain functions in order to avoid the case where we have very high unemployment due to the fact that, or very low job quality due to the fact that, that there isn't much between the top 1% and the semi-skilled types of jobs. So one way to address that question, and this is a question that I think may be addressed segment by segment and I think may require some government involvement to address, is it necessary to create incentives where without reducing our global competitiveness, we just say we're going to pay more for certain things and redistribute the wealth in that manner? And then pardon? I.e. either protections or incentives. The thing we don't want to do is increase the cost of our exports. But if we redistribute the way those costs are borne below the sort of within the construction of those things, then maybe And that would have to be done through tax incentives. It would have to be done through regulations. It would have to be done through other kinds of things. Nobody likes to hear this, right? It's very hard to do that in a mature industry. It might be possible to do that in emerging industries, right? And then, of course, the second way to do it is just with tax and redistribution, which is what nobody likes to hear. But I think we have to ask the question, because it's unrealistic to believe we can always do it using the first mechanism, right? And so maybe we then have to plan ahead for how we use one of the second mechanisms in areas that are emerging in order to at least give ourselves a fighting chance.
Any other questions?
Hi, Andy. Thanks. Thanks for coming, and Abhijit, thank you for having us and coordinating all of this, of course, to the Commonwealth Club. You partially answered the question I was just about to ask with respect to wealth distribution and synthesizing. One thing that I've always worried about, having been to a few states like New Jersey, where I see people pumping the gas, even though it's been fully automated for years, is this nanny state that we're headed toward, that's a la Europe. And it seems to me that that we can, to your point, have higher paid skilled labor when you know how to redirect calls to that individual who can answer twice the number of calls than the person who can't. And I also see the same, say, at Walmart or Target, where you're going to have go ahead and pay $13 or $14 for the person who can run six of the units, and that's where I see us headed. But in furtherance to your answer, what do you do about all those people that don't have jobs? I mean, are we going to send them out to pump gas, or what can you do? I mean, we, as a small business owner, face a lot of FICA and Social Security issues. So in software, we've also started to outsource, and the cost, now that the dollar's dropped, it's really not that much cheaper to go to India or Eastern Europe, but it is when you tackle FICA and Social Security and factor that in.
So, you know, to be fair, I think I have enough expertise to recognize this as a serious problem, and even to say that we have to tackle this problem head on, because it's only going to get worse because of the fact that we are in an increasingly global and an increasingly skilled environment. So that's a big problem, right? And I'm again, mindful of the limits of my own expertise. I think we have to be purposeful in thinking about that problem. My opinion is as follows. I mean, right now we set up a dichotomy and we say, look, we can either have a free market in which there'll be winners and losers, and the winners win and the losers, that's just their lot in life, or we can have a nanny state where we just establish a consistent standard for everyone. And that seems to me to be a simplistic construct. I think that what we have to recognize is that we have gotten ourselves into a state where there is a serious disparity. We're going to have a large number of people who are either unemployed or underemployed as a result of shifting skill mixes, right? And there's nothing we can do about it in the short term other than tackle it, other than decide what do we want to do to support people who are dislocated by the fact that we have such a changing industrial structure, right? And I think that somehow we have to chin up to the short-term consequences, and we have to say, okay, to a certain degree, we can address the problem through retraining. That's going to take some time, but there may be a degree to which we can do that. To a certain degree, we may have to do it through limited aspects of industrial policy, which have time horizons attached to them, where the idea is, look, this is just a transitional undertaking, but we'll do something hopefully that represents an investment that yields over time as well as just for people affected during that period of time. I don't see any way that we can avoid doing some of those things because of the magnitude of the problem and the fact that the global trends are not going to change. But then if we accept that is only something that we should have to do in the short term, right? And again, nobody likes that answer. Then it leaves you with, okay, well, what do you do for the longer term? And that is where I think we have to start thinking about how to build into our thinking about future industries some mechanisms which will at least forestall that happening.